Welcome to Conversations in Cannabis. Today I'm sitting down with Vince Ning, CEO and co-founder of multi-state distribution and wholesale marketplace, Nabis. We'll get to discuss how he got into the industry, his recent acquisition of Blackbird from the Herbal Receivership, and what it takes to make it in today's market climate. This podcast was recorded on April 19th, 2024.
What made you want to get into technology in the first place? Obviously, being an engineer, being somebody that loves the computer space, like, you know, that traditional movement is generally like, yeah, you're going to work for somebody like Meta, going to work for somebody like Google.
Yeah.
What made you interested?
Yeah, I mean, I think at a very young age, both my parents were actually software engineers. And so I grew up around computers. You know, I had computers in every single room, I think probably. You know, unbeknownst to me, I know I had no points of comparison because I didn't know what other kids' houses look like. And so I think I just had a lot of that around me in my environment. And so, and my parents were pretty, you know, while they were cautious around like all the video games cropping up and stuff, like they would definitely throw technology in my hands. Like they would put Game Boys and, you know, Nintendos and things like that, just because I felt like they, you know, it was their livelihood. So, and I think they saw where technology was headed and, you know, saw how fast things were changing. I remember just really young, you know, even like the first, like, I would say time when I think things changed for me was when I was just having a conversation with my mom, who at the time was working, she had just started working at Salesforce she works on, you know, database servers there. And she was explaining to me, you know, the things my dad was doing. My dad was working at AOL at the time for decades, managing mail servers. And so they kind of saw the whole like technology, you know, the whole generation crop up and like all the tech tools. And my mom was kind of just dotting the lines of like, you know, my dad went to UIUC, and that was like one of the first six supercomputer sites in the world, like along with Berkeley and Stanford. And then from there went to, you know, mail servers and all these like interconnected personal computers. And then from there, it went to touchscreens and mobile all within the span of like 20 years. And so it just, you know, even for a technologist, she was saying that like, it's hard to keep up because so much is developing so fast and you get to work with so many smart people and like, it's so dynamic. And, you know, I think this came from a question of like, I was asking them how it's possible for them to sit in a corporate job in an environment in like a cubicle for so many years, because I was like, that's sounds like a painful existence. But they were trying to convince me that in technology it's different, that's when it kind of clicked for me. But even still, I went to, you know, last thing I'll say, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit, is, and then I went to college, and I wanted to explore more because I kind of then knew that both my parents were engineers. So I kind of felt like I was, you know, sort of predetermined to go into that route. So I then explored other things that interest me. You know, I went and studied economics, I studied statistics, all fairly quantitative things. And I took enough courses to end up doing, multiple degrees at the end of the day. But computer science was always kind of like a backbone of my educational experience. And I frankly initially actually had an aversion towards doing it because I didn't want to do what my parents did. I wanted to be different. But then eventually I kind of came to my senses and understood what they were trying to preach, which is that this is the future.
Well, and it definitely is the future. Things have moved way faster than it did back then, I feel like, with the AGI and stuff like that going on now. Totally. But going into kind of like, when you're deciding, hey, I want to be a technologist or I want to be an engineer and I want to work in the traditional side of things, such as working at Salesforce, massive company in Silicon Valley, or working at Meta or Amazon or whoever, how do you eventually then transfer that into cannabis? Because I feel like that branch is so large between what people are willing to, I mean, it's back then it was almost a scarlet letter to be involved in the cannabis industry.
Totally.
What made you want to make that leap?
I mean, at the end of the day, I think what I came to learn through my relationship with technology is that technology in and of itself is kind of a manufactured, it's kind of just like it's an innovation, you know, it's kind of, but at the same time, it's kind of like a dumb tool. You know, computers are just as good as, you know, what we tell it to do in many ways. And so All that is to say is technology in my mind requires an application. There is technology developed for the sake of technology in like academical settings, just to push the boundaries of what computers can do in processing. And I think those are for like intellects, but oftentimes those can birth great companies as well when they find the right application that touches billions of people. And so cannabis was just one of those. And I felt like, building technology for the sake of it didn't necessarily fulfill me. I mean, it was a great intellectual, it tickled my intellectual curiosity, but at the end of the day, it needed an application in order to get the funding, get the, sort of, provide the impact such that I could wake up every morning, write a line of code, and see how it affects the real world. And so cannabis particularly was interesting because of the fact that, one, I actually, fun fact, dealt weed in college myself. And then two, so it was kind of a familiar territory. And then two, it was that, my previous companies, I truly was just sitting in a cubicle at a desk job. And I, at Microsoft in particular, I didn't really see the large scale impacts. I just, saw the metrics on a dashboard. But with cannabis, I really saw it. Everything I did on the technology side, I could see it improving the fulfillment process of what we did. And I could see more and more boxes piling up in our warehouse, more and more of it flowing out. And like I could walk in and see the velocity of it all. And so that was something that was really new to me. And I thought that it was an interesting place to play.
Well, and you guys raised your first Series A, I believe, right after you got out of Y Combinator, if I'm not mistaken. And you got that Series A from people that were in Y Combinator, people like DoorDash's co-founder, Twitch's co-founder, Gmail's creator. Like when you're initially talking to these types of investors about cannabis that early in the industry, how much apprehension was there for people to actually get involved from a VC standpoint?
I mean, a good amount. I would say those people a little less frictionful because of the fact that, I think technologists, especially founders, they live on the bleeding edge, and so they're more. And cannabis has definitely a well intertwined history with Silicon Valley itself in terms of its ability to tap into the creative mind and be innovative. And so between that and LSD and like all sorts of other drugs, like weed was not something that raised a flag in particular. And I think it was probably more of an interest to them. They would walk in and see a bunch of cash, see a bunch of weed, and like be really curious because they had the same experience that I used to have, which was sit behind a computer, code all day, see metrics go up, but they didn't actually see the direct impacts in the physical world. Now, I think for people that I pitched in more old school environments like family offices and such, even still today, I think that it's because it's getting more destigmatized, but those people are definitely more conservative because they might have made their money in real estate or something else that is a bit more of a traditional asset class, and all of a sudden they're being pitched cannabis. So there's definitely like a either A headline risk or B sort of like a moral dilemma that they're going through to invest. That definitely holds things at the gate sometimes. But now that these boomers, that generation is like passing down their wealth and inheritance to the younger generation, the people that are around our age are starting to look at cannabis as this actually really exciting growth category that they don't have this moral dilemma for because they grew up with it.
Well, and it absolutely have grown massively since the industry first started. A lot of different verticals now in the industry. I still remember the early 215 era of cannabis in California. Like people were just dumping Mylar bags or Ziploc bags. There were no POS systems. There was no track and trace. A lot of technology now involved in the cannabis industry. What are some of the biggest changes that you've kind of seen as a technologist in the industry from the time when you were, say, dealing weed in college to today, where it looks like we got AGI running greenhouses?
Yeah, I think people have embraced it. There used to be a strong aversion towards technology because I think while cannabis was very well interlaced into the technology space, I think the opposite wasn't exactly true. You had these growers and from, living up in Humboldt as the typical archetype of the person working in weed. And they're very relationship driven. They go to stores, dap up their buyers. Because of the fact it came from the black market, a lot of trust had to be in place. So, why use iMessage when you can use Signal and it's all encrypted? And so that was kind of the old days of like cannabis, where you had to use high secured or just, not write anything down on paper, because it was almost like it was pretty much an illegal activity, and it was very trust based, and so nothing should be documented in that way. And so, but now that the industry needs to scale, people have really embraced technology as the only way to go. So that's definitely been a big shift in terms of the adoption curve that I feel that I've felt over the years.
Well, and when you're looking at some of the adoptions and technology for the cannabis industry, it's been kind of almost mind-numbing, especially over the last couple of years, and how much adaptation traditional technologists have now taken into cannabis. When you're looking at things like, say, AI-generated bud tenders or greenhouse inspectors that are all AGI, is there one particular disruptor that you can see as like the trigger for helping move, say, cannabis from a 1.0 to a 2.0, and finally from a 2.0 to a 3.0?
I think a lot of it does, yeah, I think it's my previous point. It's just the industry hitting different levels of scale. like earlier on, you just had your little network of like buyers and sellers and in your local region, and you didn't need technology. But once the full state of California legalized, and NorCal people had to sell to SoCal people and vice versa, that's when things, you couldn't just do things that don't scale anymore. And then now we're reaching this other tipping point where there's 38 legal states, medical, recreational, and there's more. This presidential election year, there's Florida on the ballot, these like really large states nationally that are on the ballot. And as a result, it's been people are starting to think about an even greater like complex problem of how do I get my products out on a national scale. And so that certainly lends itself to having a more technologically forward approach rather than this like linear like human driven approach to scaling. And so I think that's kind of this new tipping point right now that we've identified that we just need to even adapt our own technology to fit the generalized needs for. But it's interesting though.
Well, and you mentioned Florida. Like, de Florida's definitely been on everybody's mind for a couple of years now, with their medical market hoping to go into recreational. There's been that talk about the 10% THC cap in the state. A lot of people talking about, oh, well, DeSantis might veto it. There's a lot of movement in cannabis in the United States right now. Do you feel like we are reaching a tipping point as a country where, federal legalization might happen? There's been talks with rescheduling. A lot of people are pro, a lot of people are against. SAFE Banking has passed God knows how many times in the House. Like, where are we in the vernacular of the United States as a cannabis industry stakeholder?
Oh, I mean, I'm hopeful always, but I've been wronged so many times by federal bills and legislature that I don't hang my hat on it as far as anything to do with company decision making. I think as far as that goes, I almost write it off as a possibility in order to, stay sane, first of all, from an expectation versus reality type framework of thinking. But beyond that, I think it's a fool's errand to try to predict that in a crystal ball and bet really big on like national and interstate commerce to happen. But it then I think really burns ourselves and investors. I think it's for us, like we try to see if our business model works in the current environment, and at least build optionality into our business to be able to adapt and expand if regulation changes, but not pull that trigger unless it does. So that's the way we think about making day-to-day decisions and long-term decisions, actually, for that matter.
Well, and when you're looking at, say, the international markets, I mean, you can have a market open up, out of nowhere, like Thailand. Everybody rushes in for investment, and then the government says, "Psych, like we're gonna shut everybody down. You know, so I think that that might actually be the best mindset to have, especially considering the fact that that same thing could happen in the US. You have one president deciding, oh, like, let's go on a decriminalized platform. I'm gonna tell everybody, like the coal memo, stop dealing with the states, let them do what they wanna do. And then the next one come in and wreck shop. Are you hopeful for at least some type of 280E reform in the future? Like, even if an interstate commerce platform doesn't happen, or legalization doesn't happen, or rescheduling, will banking reform at least happen?
I mean, I would hope that all of these happen at some point. I think 280E is very close on the 1 yard line here, but you know, as we've seen before, anything can happen. And there's a lot of, you know, not to sort of like downplay the importance of the cannabis industry, but there are really important, you know, policy issues and foreign relation issues that exist at the federal level today, relating to like life and death, you know? And so I just think that cannabis is, you know, if I were the president of the United States, it is definitely not the first thing that comes to mind as far as what I need to do to please my people. And so, you know, I get it. But you know, in my mind, I think it's on the same level of scale as like legalizing gay marriage. And you know, it's an important pressing social topic. And so that's something that needs to be addressed. It can't just sit still. So I think to your point, I do expect there to be iterative change, but not sweeping change.
Well, you know, I love the op-ed that you did for Marijuana Moment earlier this week, where you had kind of talked about the power of action, collective action as an industry. Being somebody that's so involved in the industry, what are some actions that you would like to see other major stakeholders make in order to help facilitate the next stage for this industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to cooperation from within each state. Like, I think because of the regulatory structure, there's every state almost has like a whole separate set of operators from soup to nuts, from cultivation all the way down to retail. And, you know, as this sort of, as the federal landscape becomes one big melting pot, you know, I think investors, operators, people on the team, like, have to kind of wrap their heads around, how do I work with this like foreign entity coming into my space, or how do I go into another market and work with someone else? And so I think a lot of those conversations are happening, and people have very different expectations because the market dynamics they may have come from can be wildly different from the ones they're trying to go into. And so you're almost like talking to an alien who like doesn't understand the physics of your world. And so those things are quite challenging, and it takes time to build the relationships for one to see the other side. And so I think, you know, tangibly, it's really, you know, can one state market adopt another market's technology tools, or can one, can a brand from one state go into another state and still succeed in that demo? And so, yeah, those are the things that, those are the conversations that I believe are happening. And even on, you know, even on an even greater scale, where there's mergers and acquisitions occurring, you know, can companies get on the same page about valuation expectations, and, you know, long-term growth needs and direction? And I think, you know, because one person comes from like a market, it might have shaped their worldview on how the market will play out, because they've had a sample size of one, and that's their sort of mental roadmap. So we definitely try to be self-aware and cognizant that we just come from California, and while it's like the biggest, baddest market out there, it's still different from a lot of other markets. So when we go into, you know, New York or Nevada or any other state that we go into in the future, it is, you know, we obviously try to learn from our past experiences, but it's not something we try to, excuse me, it's not something we try to blanketly apply to a new market, because there's always nuances within each locale.
Well, and when you're looking at mergers and acquisitions, I mean, M&A has kind of been the forefront of the cannabis industry for several years. You know, we've seen people like, most recently, Planet 13 acquire VitaCann, and now they're moving into the Florida market. When you're doing kind of your check list and you're kind of going through your KPIs and you're going through all of what you are as a business and you're looking for a partner in a viable state that you want to enter into, what are some things that operators should be asking or should be looking at in order to make sure that they're sitting with a collaborative partner that meets the same goals that they have?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think in my experience having a lot of these conversations lately, a lot of people are, I guess, you know, as the principals of the company, you're kind of prone to being optimists as well. And so a lot of people try to pair up at the dance. It's kind of one big dating game. So a lot of people pair up at the dance and, you know, they're saying, oh, my product complements your product. And I think there's a future here that 1 + 1 = 3. And I think on a product level, a lot of these things do exist. And even on a financial level, they make sense on a day-to-day operating level. But I think a lot of the tough conversations that need to be had, and more so upfront, and it's probably difficult to do before the relationship is built, is how do you value your business and how do I value my business? Because if we're going to combine forces, how does this prenup agreement need to exist such that you're being valued appropriately and me too? And it's not just how I feel about it, or you feel about it. It's how do your investors feel about it as well? And so those are the things that can block a deal right from the, like at the end of the day, you know, that, yeah, at the end of the day, those are the things that can block a deal, full stop. And so I think before going down the full rabbit hole of like mutual diligence on each side and learning about each other's companies and rallying each of our teams to meet the other side and like build a relationship, a lot of that time can be saved in resources. If some of the more like make or break, deal breaker questions can be addressed upfront, such as those things. So yeah, that's been my learning so far in looking at these deals and opportunities.
Well, and you guys acquired Blackbird from the Herbal receivership most recently, which kind of gave you an expansion into the Nevada market. When did you first become interested in Blackbird? And on an ancillary note, like how do you see the Nevada market shaping up? Obviously, it's one of the closest states to the California market.
Yeah. I mean, Blackbird has always been on our radar ever since we entered the cannabis industry at the onset, because they were in California at the time as well. And they were the only other model of business that had a technology arm and operational arm of the business that had a similar vision. So, you know, I was always friends with the original founder, Tim Condor, and, you know, still remain very close friends with him today. And, you know, when Blackbird came on the market, it was almost like too good to be true in many ways. I think because our business is, you know, it's a little different than the rest of the distribution tier, because of the technology, twist that we have on top. Blackbird always stood out as like a potential real competitor and real potential partner long term as well in this manner. So, you know, when they came on the market, it was I had to take a look. Obviously, price had to be right, and took a minute to sort of negotiate that down. But yeah, at the end of the day, it was an accretive acquisition for us, and we're still going through this sort of like transition process. And again, like similar vein of what I mentioned before, we don't want to go in and just change everything that's been happening, because it seems like it's been going really well for the past several years. And so, you know, we want to keep as much intact as possible, but be able to provide the resources to expand the business's value proposition to the Nevada market as that market continues to grow. So it was always, you know, something that has been on our radar, and lately just, I think the stars aligned to be able to step into the business.
Yeah, that price point was absolutely incredible that you guys acquired it at, by the way. And the fact that you guys made that happen was fantastic. I think everybody was a little bit shocked, though, when Herbal did collapse last year. And when you're looking at kind of the regulations and you're looking at kind of the taxations in certain markets, is this going to be a shakeout kind of period for the cannabis industry, such as, you know, the MedMens and the Herbals, where it looked like business was good and then it didn't go good? You know, how much should the industry be worried about situations like that? Or were these kind of flukes within the industry because of just bad business practices that were hidden?
I think it's a little bit of both, but I think a lot of it comes down to applying a, I mean, I guess if I'm trying to pattern match all those businesses that you're describing that have gone up and blown up in smoke, I think a lot of it comes down to people who feel a certain way about their past experiences in other industries coming into cannabis and blindly applying it to the space without really understanding how the regulations might affect that business model. And so in each of those scenarios, I do think they got caught up in trying to build a business that existed very differently in other markets. MedMen was looking at Apple as sort of their like mental model. Herbal was looking to unify, but very different regulatory space, one like and frankly unregulated in those markets. And so with that in mind, I just think that some of the bigger pieces of the business model didn't jive with the regulatory model such that it caused a gaping hole in their ship that ultimately caught up with them. Yeah, I think for us, like, as young guns entrepreneurs, we were 24, 23 at the time when we started this business. We had a mental model from tech, but it wasn't like, I think our role as tech entrepreneurs is actually going back to the first point, finding an application, understanding from like a first principles perspective what the problem set is, what the constraints are, and not, we were kind of, we had a blank slate in terms of how we looked at the industry. And so we always solved problems, and we still do today, based on the problems at hand, not problems from another industry that we try to apply here. We obviously like try to learn about how the alcohol industry grew up, or like how the tobacco industry came to be, and how it evolved over the years, to see if there are corollaries. But I don't think it is the answer, the full stop answer to how we make decisions and problem solve today to build our platform. So yeah, I think it comes down to a little bit of adaptability that some of these businesses did not have that ultimately caused their demise.
Well, and one thing that I know a lot of operators have mentioned is that they feel like regulators and people that are actually making the rules and the taxation around the cannabis industry are people that have never been in cannabis before, and they kind of have this overarching optimistic ideology about how much money cannabis can bring in, and so they kind of overtax or overregulate. Do you feel like that might start to ease up as, say, certain regulators, like you had mentioned earlier, start to age out of the industry? Younger people start coming in who maybe have a different ideology as to what cannabis regulations could be. Could we see kind of a quantitative easing in the next coming years in some of these markets?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think overtaxation occurs in a multitude of ways because the federal government kind of inadvertently taxes you more because of 280E. And then on top of that, each state has their own opinions, like you said, about how much this is going to bring to their their coffers, and they then tax. And then each city also has lops on their own taxes. And so these entities don't really talk to each other before they apply their tax rates. And so all of a sudden, one business from one business's perspective, let's say in California, you're paying 40 plus percent oftentimes, fully loaded costs, or a consumer is bearing that cost that ultimately gets passed through the value chain. And it becomes really cost, it becomes really uncompetitive compared to like a black market product. And so yeah, I think that's the sort of conundrum we have right now. And so yeah, I think as operators, we have this responsibility to put this narrative together to push back on each of the parties trying to overtax us. But it'll take some time. I think people were willing to trade high taxes for legalization, so to speak, to put it simplistically, in each jurisdiction. Now that the market's going and people understand that the taxes are fairly cost prohibitive to operating a sustainable, profitable business, that's when things will start to settle and settle back towards normalcy in terms of tax encumbrance.
We've definitely seen some craziness, at least stuff that doesn't make any sense to me, you know, like taxing gross weight on your byproduct. And it's just like, you know, that's like trying to tax an apple tree for its bark. It's like, I don't know what you're trying to do. When do you think, from an industry's perspective, like when do you think certain states that are maybe overregulated will start to look at some of the other states and say like, oh shit, we're killing our industry? Because I feel like there's a lot of businesses in California that had started during the 215 era, eventually made it, you know, through the regulatory process into 64, and a lot of those guys got vaporized by stuff that was out of their control. I mean, do you feel like we'll eventually start to see some of these people actually make effective change?
Yeah, I think, you know, there will be policy change. I think it'll continue to be slow until, you know, there's enough like resources and firepower behind lobbying. You know, if you look at other regulated industries, these businesses are like, you know, tobacco. The running joke is that they're legal firms with a product arm, as opposed to a product business with a legal arm. And same with, you know, liquor. A lot of times, like they just have very beefy policy and legal teams to, you know, put money in the right people's pockets who ultimately get elected and change regulation in their favor. And that excess of capital to think long term strategic doesn't exist in the cannabis space. Everyone's struggling to make it through day to day, and so to be able to focus on, you know, these long term policy changes, which take years to build up the relationships for and the social capital and the level of impact that's required to change a bill or a law, you know, there's just not enough resources out there. So, you know, I think right now the industry is kind of dependent on actually these other industries to lobby for the right legislation in cannabis. So I do think that, but then the trade-off is cannabis operators will then be ultimately beholden to legislation that looks a lot like legislation that comes from some of these other industries. So, you know, it's always a give and a take, but you know, I think as long as it provides sustainability for the industry, I think it's a positive direction.
Yeah, we probably don't need Alec bills being introduced into the cannabis industry.
That's right.
When you're kind of looking at, I mean, you guys have a massive presence in the cannabis space. I believe right now you're well over 400 brands represented. When you're looking at that many different verticalities in the industry, or that many different categorical approaches to the end consumer product, what has been like a major shift that you've kind of seen that has surprised you? I know we've kind of seen the evolution of edibles with nanoemulsification. We've seen a little bit of flower starting to lose ground to things like vapes, and pre-rolls. Like what are you kind of seeing from your perspective?
I think even taking a big step back, I think like the whole hemp space is crop is cropping up and becoming a very, very large category. THC brands, because of how competitive it is and how unsustainable it is oftentimes to operate in this type of market environment, they drift over to the hemp market. And so, you know, I think that there's always a lot of like interesting innovations out there. Solventless being one of the main trends, solventless extraction products, extracted type products in the past several years, you know, fresh frozen and live rosin in the past few years before that. I mean, I think each market has its own subculture and climate. Like New York, for instance, has a lot more investment into beverages because of all the bar culture and drinking culture that exists there. So every market's a little different in terms of its focus. But you know, at the end of the day, flower and pre-rolls are the biggest categories in aggregate in each market. But it's the most competitive. You know, the top 10 flower categories don't control most of that category, but the top three edibles and gummies brands own pretty much the whole gummy space. So you know, it's a tale of two stories, I think, within each category as well. But yeah, I do think that there's bigger forces at play around hemp as well lately.
Well, and just looking at, say, the edible space in particular, like we've kind of seen a shift from, say, the 215 era where people were really focused on the macro dose, you know, the biggest bang that you could purchase at the time. Now we're kind of seeing a move towards microdose, you know, the 2.5s. Do you see that trend continuing, or do you see that as kind of a divergent of a demographic where it's like, I don't see one overtaking the other. I see like half of the industry being like, hey, I want to be able to have five or six drinks and not get knocked out of my seat. Plus, you have the party mentality where it's like, I want that one drink that's going to punch me in the face. Is that a split, or is there like a actual shift happening within that category?
I think it goes by age group and demographic. I think that they'll both exist. It's kind of like liquor and beer and wine. There's different phases of your life where you go for di you choose different types of drinks. And if you're perhaps like growing up, maybe you'll have like a beer just to start like dipping your toe into the alcohol land. And then, once you go to college, maybe you start drinking liquor and go to frat parties, and it becomes more of like a how much bang for buck can I get? And then after that, it's like as you become more I guess particular about your taste around what you prefer. And once you maybe get a job and start making extra disposable income, you start drinking nicer and nicer wines and liquors, and you drink less of it, and you go for more taste than you do for potency. And so, I think it's an evolution. So they all need to exist, and they exist for different reasons. Yeah, I think that initially the market was just going for bang for buck, and I think that still largely exists today. But as these, new demographics enter the space, older generations who need it for, joint pains and mitigating health issues, and health symptoms, those are all areas of demand that are starting to surge a bit more on the low dose, sort of like common everyday occurrence microdosing form factor. So, I mean, I see a lot of the same trends with like psychedelics as well. A lot of people take like these microdose, LSD tabs, or like shroom chocolates or gummies. And people are trading that, even trading cannabis even for that sometimes to go to concerts here and there. And so yeah, I think that there's definitely a trend towards microdosing as well, because these are pretty powerful substances. So you also have to be careful around how much you do as well.
Well, and we've kind of seen a surge in the psychedelic space in the last couple of years. I mean, even Benzinga moved their Capital Conference, the Capital and Psychedelics Conference, MJ BizCon with Remind, Champs with their mycology side of things. Like when you're looking at the space as a whole, you had mentioned kind of hemp products, popping up, and a lot of cannabis brands getting into hemp in order to kind of offset possible losses in the cannabis space. Do you see any cannabis businesses potentially getting to the psychedelic space once that's available, or will people kind of stay in their own lanes?
I think so. I mean, if you look at cookies, they have like a shroom cap product already or something like that. I haven't tried it, so I couldn't tell you if it's like effective. But yeah, a lot of people, I mean, I would say a lot of people also who grew up in the cannabis industry before, like decades ago, and were on the bleeding edge, they probably prefer to be on the bleeding edge. And so even operators who now feel like cannabis is becoming a bit more corporatized will drift into a new bleeding edge of like psychedelics and growing mushrooms and stuff like that. So yeah, I think there's sort of like a way of life rationale as well for some of these operators to drift into that space too, beyond just like the trends of demand.
How fast will Nabis get into psychedelics once there's a licensed market?
Yeah, I mean, it would not be out of the question. It'd be kind of top of the list in terms of things we'd look into. I think right now we have a lot of ha our hands full with just trying to, plant our flag in all 50 states for just cannabis. But once that exists, we'll be looking to constantly do more and push the envelope in terms of what our business can accomplish.
Well, it's 420 Eve right now, obviously the eve of the biggest cannabis holiday on the planet. Again, don't have you for too much longer, and I do appreciate the time you did give. When will we start to see data from this year's holiday? And from your perspective, what do you think that we'll see? Obviously, we had a massive boost from the pandemic. There was a slight downturn after people started going back to work. Like, what will this year's 420 rollout to look like?
I mean, we have not had a bigger year of, pre 420 delivery surge, just, as a wholesale business, we kind of see the purchasing volume before 420 actually happens, because we need to get to the stores. Yeah, I mean, I think that, I don't know, I guess we'll have to see. I don't have a direct answer for you this year, or a prediction. I think it'll be more like, I think it'll be more representative of normalcy in the future in terms of like the seasonality. Because like you said, I think COVID was a very once in a generation anomaly, and back to work. So I think the sort of like pendulum swing of, uptick during 420 and downtick afterwards is probably a bit more abnormal. So I think this year is a bit more normal, in my opinion. Yeah, so that's my prediction.
Well,
Nothing too interesting.
if a brand wants to start to purchase from the Nabis platform, a retailer, or a brand wants to get onboarded by the Nabis platform, what is the process like, and what's the best way to reach out to you to get that process started?
Go to nabis.com. There's a bunch of buttons. We try to give you the breadcrumbs right away to help you find a way to onboard. Yeah, I mean, if you want to go directly, email partnerships@nabis.com. Someone will get in touch with you as soon as possible. But process is, it could take a few weeks from, our sales team will provide product demos, like software demos, and an understanding of how our workflow works in terms of how we handle your products from, intake to delivery, how we manage the payments and processing, and how we try to be communicative around it. So, yeah, it can take a few weeks depending on what the customer's needs are, but a lot of it is determining what those customers' needs are, and then figuring out what products and solutions are best for them. And then from there, it's really just like legal and signing contracts and determining which regions we want to start with, and starting to work with them. That's pretty much the general process.
Well, if you're a retailer or a brand that's operating in a market where Nabis is currently operating, I mean, you already know who the hell they are. They're the biggest name in the space for what they do. So definitely go check them out at nabis.com. Again, Vince, really appreciate your time, especially considering the fact that tomorrow is 420 and you got to be out of your mind busy right now. So again, really
Exactly.
appreciate it and look forward to following up with you after the holiday and seeing how you guys did.
Thanks so much.
We would like to thank Vince for his time and being on today's episode. If you would like to find out more about Nabis, please visit them online at www.nabis.com. And that'll do it for us today. Thanks again for listening, and as always, make sure to stay tuned to the next episode here on Conversations in Cannabis.